Okay, so y'all ready to get started? So here we are in chapter 3, right? Chapter 3 is called the Economic Decision Makers. So let me explain very briefly what chapter 3 is all about. First, remember that the first four chapters are just introductory chapters, right? They're neither macro nor micro, but they're simply a discussion of some terms and principles, concepts, and an introduction to a certain way of thinking. All of these things that we talk about in the first four chapters we'll use in great detail after chapter 4. But for now, what we're still looking at this thing is sort of like an overview. And so what your author does here in chapter 3 is he says, let's look at the economy in a macro sense. Who makes up the economy? Now, first of all, the economy is made up of flesh and blood, right? I mean, if you took all the people out of the economy, would we have an economy? I mean, we would have buildings and machines and roads and all of that, but we wouldn't have an economy. See, the economy is our people, and people are flesh and blood, and people are motivated by emotion more than anything else. And so that is what makes up the economy, see? And so what your author does here, he says, well, let's look at some of the main parts of the economy, namely the household sector. And so we talk about the household sector, some of the characteristics, some of the recent history, some of the trends, some changes have taken place. And then we look at the business sector, we do the same, and then the government sector, and then the foreign sector. Now, everyone who spends money has got to fall into one of these four sectors. In fact, these four sectors make up what we call gross domestic product, which we'll talk about in a later chapter. So what we're doing right now is we're just going to talk about the major characteristics of the household and some of the changes that have taken place over the past 25, 30 years or so. So, one thing that has really changed, if you go back to the post-World War II, 1950s, 1960s, and especially since the 70s, one big change has taken place is that we've had more women in the workforce. Now, the workforce, by the way, is defined as all those who are either gainfully employed or who are seeking gainful employment. That's the workforce. It's not the entire population here. It's just those who are gainfully employed or who are seeking gainful employment. So more women have entered the workforce, and because of that, of course, the two-income family is much more common than it was before. So why are there more women in the workforce today? So we're going to go back to the 1970s, and particularly now, the 1970s is something that we really do want to pay a lot of attention to, because a lot of the same problems that we had in the 70s are appearing again. So let me talk to you about the 1970s. The 1970s was a period of what is called stagflation. Now, we had to invent that word in the 70s. Stag means the economy is stagnating, and inflation means the economy is inflating at the same time. Before the 1970s, if we had inflation, then we normally had full employment. And if we had rising unemployment, then we had either stable or falling prices. But never before in history have we had such a period where we had both rising prices and rising unemployment at the same time. Now, in the later chapter, we're going to find out exactly why that happened. I mean, what caused stagflation? But right now, we're just kind of hitting it on the surface very lightly, and I'm going to explain how the stagflation of the 70s brought about so much change. Because, you see, change is inevitable. I mean, by the very fact that we're living, we can expect change. The only thing that we know about tomorrow is that it'll be different than today. And So, first of all, let's talk a little bit about the about stagflation. Before the 70s, the one-income family was the norm. Now, can you all paint for me a picture of the typical all-American family? I mean, ideally, baseball, apple pie, white picket fence, house in the suburbs, three bedrooms. How many children?
Two
cars. One of them is maybe a... or I was thinking more like a station wagon or something like that. And maybe a dog, a collie dog, something like that. Cocker spaniel, a cat or two. A weeping willow tree in the backyard with a swing underneath it. Y'all get the picture, right? Now, in this typical all-American family, who works, the man or the wife, the husband or the wife? The husband works. And what hours does he work? 9 to 5, 8 to 5, Monday through Friday, right? And so you've got one income. And do you have a, is this family, has this family experienced a divorce? No. Now, how many families do you think in America today come close to fitting that ideal?
Not many.
Less than 5%, probably closer than 3% of families come even close to fitting that ideal. Well, that's what we're trying to talk about. I mean, what has brought about, so much change? Now, what I'm saying? It's so easy for us to become accustomed to what is. Or if you're young, you grow up in a certain situation, and it's easy to think, this is the way things have always been. But this is not the way things have always been. Change has taken place. Things are quite different today than they were 25, 30 years ago. And one thing, see, with rising with inflation, now the inflation rate in the 70s was about 10% a year. Now, do y'all know the rule of 72? I mentioned this last semester, but the rule of 72 is if you take any incremental increase and divide into 72, that'll give you how long that value will double. So if we had an inflation rate of 10% annual in the 70s, how long would it take prices to double? Well, 10%, 10 goes in 72, how many times? About 7. So that the rule of 72 says that with an inflation rate of 10%, the prices will double every 7 years. Now, how many people's incomes do you think doubled in 7 years during the 1970s? Not too many. So what happened to the average family? The average family found themselves with more and more month and less money, right? I mean, has everyone here ever run out of month before he ran out of money? Or am I the only one? So, also, of course, with rising unemployment, what happened? Well, a lot of families were affected by that rising unemployment. So what was the answer to this problem that the average family faced? Yeah, see, the answer was the second income. Let's send someone else in the family, usually it was a wife and mother, let's send her out into the workforce, and this way we can make more money and solve this financial problem. You see, if we have a similar situation today, which I expect we will, and it may even be worse, what's one big problem we have today? I mean, compared to the 70s. Well, the big problem we have today is that in our country, a man can only marry one wife, right? I mean, if she's already working, where's the safety valve? See, there was a safety valve back in the 70s. But if the same thing occurs today, you see, we don't have that same safety valve. So anyway, what happened here is that what a lot of people thought would be a temporary situation really became permanent. They said, well, you know, you just go out into the workforce and you make some money and we'll pay off these bills and then you can come home and be with the kids again and after 2 or 3 years, everything will be fine. Of course, after 2 or 3 years, what happened? Well, what did a lot of families do with this money? I mean, did they pay off their bills put money in the bank and do all that? What do most families do? Yeah, they spent it. You know, they bought a bigger car or a second car. Of course, you need a second car because you got two incomes now instead of one. But, you know, you buy a bigger house and you know, a nice neighborhood and you get accustomed to going out to eat more often and this and that. And pretty soon, you see, your lifestyle now is dependent upon two incomes. And so what happened is that what was a thought to be a temporary situation really became a permanent. Now, what has this got to do with higher education levels? Well, when the wife and mother first went into the workforce back in the 70s and 80s, what kind of income could she expect to make? I mean, who had the education in the family, the husband or the wife? See, it was the husband that had most of the education, I mean, normally, the skills, or, you know, he was the traditional breadwinner. And so what kind of jobs could she expect to get? Well, secretary, minimum wage type job, you know, librarian, retail sales, things like that, right? So, so when this situation, you see, became more or less permanent, what did a lot of these women begin to think? Hey, if I'm going to work, I'm going to get paid more. But how am I going to get paid more? Go to school. You know that nationwide, 55% to 60% of all college students are female. And that's true at New River. 55% of all students at New River are female. That's what's happened. You see, I mean, women have said, "Look, I mean, if I'm going to work, I at least want to make a higher wage." And so, that's one change that's taken place. A more educated population, especially amongst women. And more professional type jobs open up to women. Now, of course, with two incomes, there are many factors to an increase in the divorce rate, but that is something that has occurred, at least increased. Not that, you know, there was no divorces back in the 50s and 60s, but the divorce rate today is much higher than it was. And in fact, today the divorce rate is about 50%. You know, 50% of those people that get married end up in divorce. You know, y'all know what the divorce rate is in Pulaski for people under the age of 25?
Hold on. 95%.
That was in the paper a while ago. So this is an increase. One change has taken place, and one point that's being made here is that when we talk about inflation, or we talk about unemployment, or we talk about that second income, what we're really talking about here is certain fundamental changes in our whole way of living. I mean, there's more changing here than meets the eye. And one change, one result of this two incomes and harried lifestyle, and you see, because how much difference in a marriage would it be if you had two teachers, they both left the house at 8:30 in the morning, they both got home 4:30, 5 o'clock, 5 days a week, they both had their weekends off. They both had a long Christmas vacation, Thanksgiving week off. They had a long summer off together. I mean, how much change would that make? Well, I don't think that would make much change at all. I mean, for the family, for the marriage. But you see, why do many families that have two incomes strive to have two different work schedules? I mean, one works days, the other works nights. One works during the week, the other works on the weekends. Huh? Time for the kids. Exactly. Time for the kids. You know, time spent with them, or you cut down on babysitting costs or school costs. I mean, these are young families primarily we're talking about, and so what happens in a family where not only do you have two incomes, but you've got two completely different work schedules. See, what happens is that there's a breakdown of communication in the family, and of course there's a lot of temptations out there too in the work world, and a lot of times this ends up in divorce. I mean, this is one reason, or I'm sure there's many reasons, but this is one reason why there's been a big increase in the divorce rate since the 60s. And that's what we're talking about here. What we're talking about is how has life changed for the household since maybe the 50s or 60s. It's changing a lot right now.
Because
how's that?
Job losses now are mostly men. It's construction.
Oh yeah. Did you read that?
Yeah, yeah. I heard it on. I forget.
It's a Kramer
or something.
Oh. Well, I haven't read that, but I can see that. I mean, that makes sense.
So,
in other words, one of the bad things today is that not only are people losing their jobs, but it's the main breadwinner that's losing his job, right? And that's causing big problems. Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. Yeah, you know, the unemployment rate increased more last month than ever before in history. In 1 month, that our economy is in a virtual free fall. Well, we'll talk about more on that later. I mean, I could really get off into that one, but later in the semester, you know, we're going to talk about things that, deal with what's happening today. But I don't want to get, off into that. I just want to stick to the, overview here. But there has been quite a big change in attitudes toward, marriage and things like that. You see, one thing about interesting thing about this is change in attitudes and the increase in the divorce rate. Typically, what kinds of things around the house does the husband do? What kind of chores does he do? Can somebody name one? Mow the lawn, take out the trash.
Feed the cows.
Feed the cows. Well, I never heard that one before, but that's a good one. You can do that early in the morning, right, or late at night, or in the evenings.
In the evening.
In the evening. And what else? How about painting the fence? How about cutting the grass? See, these are things that can be done on the weekends, right? Except feeding the cows, but I mean, a lot of things that the man does can be done on the weekends. And if the fence isn't painted this weekend, well, we can paint it next week. And if the grass isn't cut this week, well, we can cut it next week. I mean, it's, why? Well, because, typically, traditionally, now, this is traditional, it was the man who worked during the week, and he had less time during the week, but he could do those things on the weekend. So, since the wife was not working, traditionally I'm talking about here, what kinds of things did she do? I mean, when I say working, I mean being gainfully employed outside the home. What kind of things does the wife typically do, traditionally? Who does the grocery shopping?
The
Who cooks the meals? Who cleans the house? Who puts the kids to bed? Who changes the diapers? Y'all with me on this? Yeah, right. Finally, somebody answered that. So see, now, I mean, this is a full-time job. I mean, you know, doing the shopping and you know, running the household and cooking the meals and just planning the meals is a big deal. And that works okay because, I mean, we've got a division of labor here. I mean, you know, he's working out there in the business world, and she's home, and they both have a full-time job, so to speak. Well, she goes out into the workforce, and now she's working 40 hours a week the same as he is. Now, in many cases, many families, who changes the diapers?
What?
Who does the grocery shopping?
What?
Who cooks the dinner? Who cooks the meals?
What?
Who cleans the house?
What?
Now, well, you got all those right. You get 100%. So, extra credit. Yeah. So what begins to seep into her consciousness?
Oh, man, I need to quit my job.
Well, her job, yeah. Or, I mean, what does she feel like? I mean, she's working essentially two jobs, and his lifestyle hasn't really changed much. I mean, he still comes home at 5:30. He, you know, dinner's still ready at 6:30. He still watches the news. He still reads the paper. He still, life really hasn't changed much for him. Yeah, one or two things can happen. Either there's a fundamental change that takes place, and he says, you know, my dad never changed diapers, or my dad never did the grocery shopping, but things are different today, and and I'll do more around the house, and how they work it out is, there's no right or wrong way. It's just, up to the family, but there's a more of a division of labor here. Or if he's hard-nosed and is unwilling to change, then what happens? Yeah, and that's how divorce fits in here. She, huh?
Or couples counseling.
Hopefully that comes first, and hopefully they can, the marriage can be worked out. But I mean, if he's, if he's unwilling to, see, one thing about human nature, because remember, you got to remember that the economics is flesh and blood and emotion, right? Now, one thing about human beings is that we tend to seek that which is familiar. Whatever is familiar to you, that's what you'll seek. In fact, advertisers, marketers have capitalized on this because. Have you ever noticed that if you go to shopping, like for a box of cereal, what shape box is it in? Have you ever seen a square cereal box? See, they're all rectangle, but most of the things that we buy are in rectangular form, and the reason is that the 2-to-1 ratio is so common in nature. You know, your hand is twice as long as it is wide. Your head is twice as high as it is wide. You know, that door over there is twice as high as it is wide. I mean, it's, the leaves on the trees, I mean, the 2-to-1 ratio is so common in nature. And because people tend to gravitate toward that which is familiar, if you have a cereal box that's square and a cereal box that's rectangle, 9 out of 10 times, everything else being equal, the consumer will buy the rectangular box. Now, the whole point I'm making here is that one of the reasons that men some of them are unwilling to change is because people are reluctant to change. I mean, whatever becomes familiar, you become comfortable with, and most people, especially the older you get, the people are unwilling to get out of their comfort zone. I mean, have you ever known gals that maybe were raised in a in a alcoholic family where maybe their father was an abusive alcoholic, and 9 out of 10 times, what kind of man do they marry? Yeah, why? Well, because that's what they're familiar with. That's, you know, they gravitate toward that. See, I mean, it's a natural law. I mean, it's not a law. I mean, not like, you know, the law of gravity, but I mean, it's a natural tendency, I should say. Okay? Now, this does have a lot to do with economics, because you can't understand the economy unless you understand what motivates people. Because people make up the economy. And people are emotional beings. They're not logical. You know, you could go to a mental hospital and logically explain to a lot of those patients that they just changed their behavior, they'd be a lot better off. Well, is that going to cure them? I mean, what do they say? Oh, well, what you say is logical and makes sense, so I think I'll just change my behavior. I mean, is that the way it works? No. Why? Because people don't make decisions based on logic. Most of the time, they make decisions based on emotion. And the last thing here is higher taxes. You see, with two incomes, of course, their family's making more income, and therefore income taxes increase. But another reason income taxes increase is that, let's say that even today, you have two people, and each of them makes $30,000 a year, and they pay taxes on that. Let's say that's taxable income. And they get married, and they're still making, you know, their $30,000 a year. What happens to their taxes, their federal income taxes? No, it goes up. It's called the marriage penalty. You know, two people who are married that make the same income as they did while they were single will end up paying more in federal income tax. And how come that is? Because that's where the money's at. Well, yeah, the kids are, there are deductions, or not deductions, exemptions, and the more kids you have, the more exemptions you have. That's all part of the tax, but everything else being equal here, what I'm saying is that when you have, two income families are taxed more heavily, because that's where the money's at. You know, the government goes after where the money's at. And there's more money in these two-income families than one-income families. So anyway, that explains this higher taxes. This shows us that about 64% of people make their income through wages and salaries. Now, what is the lowest form of making money? A wage, right? The lowest form of making money is with a job, where you're trading hours for dollars, and it is the way of making money that is that you can't shelter your income like you can with other types of income. And yet, 64% of people make their money this way. 13% of people make their money through interest. See, a lot of these are retired people. And of course, if you're making money through interest, then you're duplicating yourself. Your money's working for you rather than you working for the money. Only 8% of the people make their money through a business, owning a business. Okay, what are transfer payments? Transfer payments are cash or in-kind benefits given to individuals as outright grants from the government. Like Social Security would be a transfer payment. You know, when the government takes money from this group and gives it to these people over here, that's what we call a transfer payment. And a big part of government spending is in the form of transfer payments. And these transfer payments have greatly... they've increased and changed over the past 20 to 30 years. And we'll look at that more in detail later on. Now, what do households spend their money? We can divide it up into three categories: durable goods, non-durable goods, and services. Durable goods are goods that have a shelf life, like an automobile or a computer. Non-durable good are things like food. When you buy it, you eat it up, it's gone. And of course, services are things like paying an accountant to do your taxes, getting a haircut, and things like that. So every dollar that the household spends can be, you know, divided into one of these three areas. Now, why does household production still exist? In fact, household production, you know, the home-based business is one of the fastest-growing industries in America. In fact, maybe even the world. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that, because this has changed households greatly. That, you know, that the internet has greatly leveled the playing field. In other words, it's much easier today for a person starting with nothing to really make it in terms of owning their own business because of the internet. Now, one example of this is I think I told you before that I teach a personal finance course, you know, FIN 107, but I also teach a personal investments course where you learn how to evaluate stocks and how to buy and sell and all of that. Well, what you learn in that personal investments course is that there are places you can go on the internet where you can get information. Now, I'm talking about gaining information so you can evaluate companies, so you know what's a good company to buy, what's like that. That 10 years ago, even 10 years ago, would have cost you thousands of dollars a year to attain. In other words, information today is freely available on the internet that 10 years ago would have cost you thousands of dollars to attain. See, now that alone has greatly leveled the playing field. I mean, knowledge is so much cheaper today and more readily available today, even, you know, easier to access today. I mean, there's been a tremendous change in these financial websites over the past 10 years. I mean, it's amazing what you can tap into just with a click of the mouse. And that information can allow you to go into your own business and be wealthy, much more than was the case even 10 years ago. That's one big change that's taken place. And I told you once before about, some of you were here last semester, so, you know, you've heard this before, but remember me talking about that lady that last year made over $1 million in Second Life? Y'all know what Second Life is, right? You know, that's the virtual world on the internet, and you go in there and you make up your character, you as a character, and you give yourself a name and a physical appearance, and then in the Second Life, if they've got money called Lindens, and which you can buy with dollars or earn in Second Life, and then you can you can buy and sell real estate, and you can attend the Harvard University even has lectures on Second Life, and you can go and you can pay and attend a lecture, and I mean you can do all kinds of stuff. And this lady made over $1 million in real money last year. That's what she did. She just sat at home and she bought and sold and went into businesses and all this in the virtual world. Yeah, there's an exchange rate. Like if you take there's an exchange rate. So many Lindens equals $1. So you buy so many Lindens, and then if you buy and sell real estate, for example, or go into business or sell merchandise, and you make people buy from you, and you make Lindens, and you can exchange them back to dollars. And when she exchanged her Lindens back to dollars, in 1 year she made over $1 million. Now. Yeah, it's like the real world. Now, Now, let's say that you in this virtual world buy property from somebody, and you have a contract with this person, and they renege on the contract, and you lose money. Do you have recourse in the court of law? I mean, in the real world.
Yes,
you do. There's been court cases. In fact, I've got a friend whose daughter now specializes in virtual world legalities. That's all she does.
Do they do it in court of law?
No, in real court.
No, they still have virtual lawyers.
They might. I don't know. I mean, this thing is just in its infancy, actually. But I mean, I mean, it's kind of interesting to talk about this, especially. You know, I mean, anyone here ever had dealings in Second Life?
I'm going to
that today. No. Yeah, just type in Second Life, secondlife.com, I believe it is. But if in Google, just put Second Life, and it'll pop right up. And then you download this a program. It's a quick download. It's not a big program, but there's a little program that you download, and then through that program, that's how you enter into Second Life. Anyway, it's the whole point I'm making here. You say, well, what in the world is he? And what's the whole point here? Well, the point here is that the household, and that's what we're still talking about, the household can. I mean, there are more opportunities available today than ever before, primarily because of the internet. It's been a wonderful thing. I mean, it's changed life. It's changed my life greatly. I mean, you know, most of what I do is online. I've got 5 online courses, and my life has greatly changed because of this technology. Okay, let me see. Now we're going to leave the household sector, and we're now going to talk about the business sector. Okay, so. What are the 3 ways entrepreneurs organize firms? In other words, if you went into your own business, what are some basic business organizations you could go into? How could you organize yourself? Well, as a sole proprietor, or as a partnership, or as a corporation. So we're going to talk about each one. See, what is a sole proprietorship? A firm with a single owner who has the right to all profits and who bears unlimited liability for the firm's debts. You know, by far the vast majority of businesses today are sole proprietorships. Now, if you want to go in your own business, do you need a license? For in most cases, the answer is no. Now, if you've got a food business, you might need a local license, but in most cases, all you got to do is go in your own business. Now, what is the IRS? How do they judge whether you are a bona fide business or not? That you have a bona fide business or not? Their test is simply, are you attempting to make a profit? If whatever you do, you can show that this is a viable business and you are attempting to make a profit, then you are a business. You own a business. And then all you got to do in tax time, halfway down the 1040 form, which is the main tax form, there's a line that says profit or loss through Schedule C. And Schedule C is another form that you use for your business. But all you got to do is write down your expenses and then write down, you know, incomes you made and give your business a name. You use your social security number, so you don't need a tax number or anything. You don't need anything really. And then halfway down the 1040 form, you put, I made this much money or I lost this much money. Now let's say You see, most people who are in their own business don't do it full time. Most people who own their own sole proprietorships have a full time job and do this on the side. So we're not talking about one or the other here. Now, let's say that you make $70,000 a year on a job, and you have this small part-time business, and you can show that you've lost $10,000. You know, you had income, but you also had expenses, and your expenses were $10,000 more than your income. Well, then what happens is that that $10,000 is a takeaway from your on-the-job income. If you made $70,000, now you're only taxed on $60,000. So you made $10,000 on the job that you don't pay any taxes on. See, this is one incentive for people to go into their own business. Now, why did the government make laws like this? Because the backbone of the American economy is the small business. All big businesses started small. And most of the job creation in this country is from small businesses, not big businesses. So to encourage people to go into their own business, the government says, look, if you just do it, we'll help you. See, it's a win-win situation. I mean, if you go in your own small-time business and you make $10,000, maybe you owe taxes on it, maybe you owe $3,000 taxes on it, but you still hit $7,000, right? So if you make money, you win. If you lose money, you win. Because whatever money you lose is a takeaway from your on-the-job income, which you pay no taxes on. So it's a win-win situation. Y'all follow me on this? You make $70,000 on a job. You lose $10,000 on a business. Yeah, and your business is separate, but in your small part-time business you lost $10,000. We were saying, so instead of paying taxes on $70,000, now you're only paying taxes on $60,000. Right. Because halfway down your 1040 form, there's a line that says profit or loss, Schedule C. And if you make a loss of $10,000, then that right away is a takeaway from what you pay taxes on, your total income.
Because
the government wants people to go in their own business. Yeah, it's an incentive. It's a tax incentive for people to go in their own business.
Is it tax fraud if you buy a bunch of electronics?
All right, now that's an excellent question. That's an excellent question. So let me answer it. The IRS says, looks at you and they say, are you a bona fide business? Are you attempting to make a profit? Is this a business you're involved in, or is it simply a hobby? And whatever you can do to show that this is a business, and there are many ways you can do this, by careful record keeping, some things that I'll mention, but the more you can show that you're a business, then all these deductions you qualify for. Now, if you're reckless and can't really you claim it but can't really show that you've been active and really are a business, that you really are attempting to make a profit, then they might say, well, no, you're not a business, you're this is just a hobby, so you can't claim this. Well, yeah, that's what Schedule C is all about. Schedule C, you have a Schedule C for each business you're in. Like, I mean, there are some years I've had three or four Schedule Cs. See, you have, and I've always had a full-time job. So you have a full-time job, and then you might be in this business. You got a Schedule C, and you give it a name, and you list your expenses, and you list your costs, and you keep careful records. Here's my receipts, and this is how I used it, and see what I mean. And you do that all in Schedule C. But then on Schedule C, at the very bottom, you get a profit or loss, and then you take that profit or loss and you put it on your 1040 form. And you do that for each Schedule C you have. You have a separate Schedule C for every business you're in. Now, we're talking about sole proprietorships here. Sole proprietorships. You know, I went to know a guy that liked to go fishing on Clayer Lake, and so what he did is he said, you know, I'll just take people fishing, and I'll charge them money, and then I'll form my own business. He gave his business a name, and he became a retailer for some fishing companies, fishing gear and things like that, where he sold, and like he became a salesman. And then now all of a sudden his boat's a tax deduction, his gasoline's a tax deduction, all his fishing gear's a tax deduction, his trip back and forth to the lake's a tax deduction, and he's just going fishing in Clayer Lake. And now, all this becomes a tax deduction. But again, he had to show that he is a bona fide business. That, he's serious about this. He does charge people, they do pay him money, he does have, these investments, and, he has made some income, and he's attempting to make a profit. See, I've heard this other guy who liked to go to racetracks, the car races, and he liked photography. So he would go to the racetracks and take pictures and take them home and make prints out of them and frame them and then take them back to the racetracks and sell them. And all of a sudden, all his camera equipment is a tax deduction, and his ticket into the racetrack is a tax deduction. So you convert an interest into a tax deduction. Now you can do that as long as you can show the IRS that you are attempting to make a profit, and that you can prove by receipts and your activities that that you are a bona fide business. Okay? And if they say, this is just a hobby, you're not really serious about this. Where's all your receipts? Where's all your, proof that you've done this and you've done that? Then they'll disallow it. So it's not tax cheating by far. It's just taking advantage of the tax system, and that's why the laws are there, to encourage people to do things like this. Because lo and behold, maybe you go in a small part-time business and based around an interest, and it grows into a big business someday. That's very common. And maybe someday you quit your job and you just do the business. You mean who makes a decision whether you're a business or not? Some tax, auditor, who's ever looking at your tax forms. Yeah, we're talking about federal tax here.
So
if the IRS really declares that no, this is not a business but it's simply a hobby, then you've got to go back and pay taxes on all that money, just like you didn't claim in the first place, and there may be some penalties involved. Knowing the IRS, they're pretty hard nosed. It's like anything else. There are laws, and if you meet the requirements of the law, then you're okay. Now, if you abuse the law, then maybe bad things will happen to you. But just because some people abuse the law doesn't mean that you ought not take advantage of it in a legal sense. Now, what is a partnership? A partnership is similar to a sole proprietorship, except you have more than one person involved. Many law firms, for example, are partnerships. Now, tax-wise, a partnership is similar to a sole proprietorship, But one of the downfalls of a partnership is that each partner is 100% liable for the debts of the business. In other words, if you go in a partnership with somebody, and let's say you each put in $100,000, let's say you have $100,000 or $200,000 of debts, and your partner skips town, and the IRS can only find you. How much of those debts are you responsible for?
All of them.
All of them. See, each partner is 100% liable for the debts of the business. So it's very important to know if you do go in a partnership, who you go in a partnership with, and how trustworthy this person is. Okay, well, what about a corporation? What is the advantage of forming a corporation? A corporation is a legal entity owned by the stockholders whose liability is limited to the value of their stock. Well, this talks about stockholders and stock, but a corporation doesn't need to sell stock in order to be a corporation, because there are different forms of corporation. There's a C-Corp, which normally stock would be sold, but there's also Chapter S and a limited liability corporation. So first of all, let me talk to you about what a corporation is. I once knew of a gas station owner that ran his business as a sole proprietorship. And one day someone slipped on a grease puddle in his driveway and broke their back. And they sued him. And as a result, he lost his business, he lost his home, he lost his cars, he lost his wife because she divorced him over all this. And in other words, he lost everything. Now, for a measly, $100, $150 or so, he could have gone to the lawyer and formed a corporation, maybe a Chapter S or an LLC. And then the business would have had a separate entity. The advantage of a corporation is that the corporation is a legal person. And then when this person sued him, well, he might have lost his business over it, but he wouldn't have lost his house and his cars and all his personal assets, because the whole purpose of corporations is to separate one's private assets to one's business assets. Now, most businesses today are sole proprietorships, but why would a person go beyond that and form a corporation? I mean, if you went into your own business, when would you not worry about forming a corporation, and when would you form a corporation? No, what's the difference here? No. The difference is liability. Liability. If you're in a business that doesn't have much liability, then there's no form for you to go through the extra mile and form a corporation. But now, like I once had a business where my last year in owning this business, I had 92 caregivers, 92 people that I sent out, and they went into household, helped elderly people in their homes, and is 24/7. Now, how much liability would be involved in that? I mean, you're taking unskilled people and you're sending them into elderly people's homes that are dependent upon them, for all kinds of, physical needs. I mean, how much liability is in that? A lot. To go in an elderly care business and not have, not as a sole proprietorship would be insane. You see? But if you're in another type of business, well, maybe you don't have that kind of liability. Then, maybe you want to run it as a sole proprietor, because tax-wise, the sole proprietorship is the easiest thing. I mean, tax-wise, you just fill out Schedule C and you put down your expenses and you put down your income and then you put profit or loss on your 1040 form, and that's it. See, it's so easy. A corporation, any kind of corporation, is a little bit more involved tax-wise and record-keeping-wise. Now, mainly, big businesses are ones who have chapter, C corporations are mainly big corporations. Although anybody could form a C corp, but it's just with a C corp, there's just a lot more, paperwork and more laws involved. A chapter S and a limited liability corporation are very simple. Not as simple as a sole proprietorship, but a lot more simple than a C corp. Okay, so this gives us this shows us that the vast majority of businesses. I mean, if you put all businesses in America in a straight line, I mean, big businesses and just a small neighborhood mom and pop shop, you know, regardless of size, you just put them all in a straight line. The vast majority of them would be sole proprietorships. But if you look at it in terms of income, then it's your corporations that make 88% of the income. So it's your big businesses that are corporations, and it's your small businesses that are sole proprietorships. Okay, what is market failure? Now, what we're doing here is, we're looking at these four sectors of gross domestic product, right? And we looked at the household sector, and then we looked at the business sector, and now we're going to look at the government sector. Okay? So, what is market failure? A condition that arises when unrestrained operation of markets yields socially undesirable results. Now, here is really the heart and core of what we are going, of what we do in economics. First of all, we learn how a free market works. And that's a lot about the first four chapters. And we learn with a free market, you see, like if you go back to Adam Smith, the father of modern day economics, where he wrote the book The Wealth of Nations, published in 1776. And what Adam Smith did back in 1776, he said, look, I mean, how is it that an economic system where you have no central authority, the system happens to produce those things that people want and provides those things to the consumers at reasonable prices? I mean, how does all that work? I mean, how is it that we, over a period of time, sometimes we have surpluses and sometimes we have shortages, but I mean, over a long period of time, the system tends to give us what we want in the right proportions. I mean, how does all that work? Well, that's a lot of what we talk about here. I mean, how does a free market work? And we learn that a free market can do many wonderful things. But what we're going to look at now is a free market can't provide us with everything. And what are those things that they cannot provide us with? And how have we modified the market so that it will perform and give us those things that a perfectly free market will not give us. Now, later on, we're going to talk about a lot what's happening today, but I don't think I have the magazine here. I had a magazine yesterday, my lecture, from the latest Newsweek. The latest Newsweek magazine, it says on the cover in big, bold letters, it says, we are all socialists now. And they talk about some of these changes that are taking place right this moment that are transforming this country into a socialized country, from a more of a market-oriented economy to a government-directed economy. I mean, that's what's happening right now. So this is a current topic here, and we're going to talk about this. But first of all, we're just going to look at why do we have to modify the system? In other words, what is the role of government? And these are some of the things that reasons why we need a strong central government. Now, see, some people think that if you're going to have freedom in a free market system, then the less government you have, the better. But the correct laws give more freedom than they take away. You know, for example, you might say, I don't think that I should be restrained to driving on the right side of the road. I mean, I should have the freedom to drive on whichever side of the road I want. If I want to drive on the left side, I should be able to drive on the left side. I mean, isn't that freedom? Well, I mean, if we had that kind of supposedly freedom, you could drive on either side of the road you want, what would happen? I mean, we'd have chaos, right? I mean, can you imagine driving down the street and some people driving on the left and some on the right, and it's like dodging cars? I mean, how fast could you drive? I mean, could you go 55, 65 miles an hour down the road and not worry about it? No. I mean, everyone would be creeping along, and you know what I mean? I mean, you see, in one way, the law says, thou shalt not, right? Thou shalt not drive on the left-hand side of the road. Now, in a small way, that law takes away freedom, but in a much larger way, it gives us back more freedom than we lose. You see how that works? You see, I mean, there are good laws and there are bad laws. But we do need government to establish rules of the game and to enforce those rules of the game so that we have order. A free market system cannot function in chaos, and it can't function in an atmosphere of uncertainty. In fact, why did, just yesterday, the stock market fell over 400 points? And what was the reason? Anybody know the reason? The what? That's part of it. But yesterday, the new Secretary of the Treasury gave a speech. And what did he or did he not say in that speech that caused the stock market to fall over 400 points? Instead of being specific about what the government is going to do, he talked very much in generalities and gave the impression that that there's a lot of uncertainty out there. And investors, because what was communicated to investors was doubt and uncertainty, they panicked and there was a big sell-off. You see, the point I'm making is that one of the things that a free market system cannot endure is uncertainty. I mean, if you're a business person and you're going to make an investment, no matter what investment you make, are there any guarantees? Are there any guarantees that you'll make a good return? I mean, some investments are more sure than others, but no one can tell the future for sure, right? There's always uncertainty here. But if you have confidence that your investment will bring you a profit, then you will choose to make that investment. But the more uncertainty that comes into the picture, you see, then the less chance of you making that investment. And so the point here is that a strong central government with the proper laws, the correct laws, and those laws that are administered in the right way bring about stability and certainty, and that fosters a free market system. Now, the government can do the opposite. That's what's happening today. The government can sow seeds of doubt and uncertainty and cause big economic problems, you see. But, ideally, a strong central government it will establish and enforce rules of the game that lead to more economic growth and more freedom than without it. Well, another role of government is that government promotes competition. Now, have you ever heard the old adage, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer? Anybody ever heard that one before? And does that tend to be true? It does. It does. Because that is a tendency. Now, I've talked about this before. Remember, I talked about how that law that says that he who has will be given more, and that person that has not, then what he does not have is taken away. Remember I talked about that? If you have $1,000 and put it into a savings account, what does the bank do? Pays you money. Why does it pay you money? Because you had money. Now, if you don't have money and you got to buy things on credit, you end up paying interest. So why does the bank take away money from you in interest? Because you did not have the money to begin with, right? So because you didn't have money, money was taken away from you, correct? So what this explains is, those who have money tend to get more money. And the more money you get, the more money you receive. And so what this can lead to is a great imbalance of, a few people have a lot and a lot of people have little. And it also leads to it's possible certain companies can take advantage of this and grow very large and stifle competition. So one of the purposes of government is to kind of level the playing field. We have what are called antitrust laws. And antitrust law says that if companies merge and that new entity has a great deal of market power, then we're going to declare it illegal. Because we don't want, around the turn of the 9th century in the 1900s, we had things that were business organizations called trusts. And there was the steel trust, there was the copper trust, there was the tin trust, there was this trust, there was that trust. And what happened is that companies in the same industry, instead of competing against one another, they started to cooperate with one another, and they operated as if they were monopolies. I mean, they cooperated, and they together agreed to charge higher and higher prices. And so an antitrust law is a law that says, well, you can't do that. You can't. I mean, if the combination results in too much market power in one business entity, then we're going to declare that illegal and not allow it. So that's one reason why we have government. Okay, we need government to promote more competition. Of course, now government can also do the opposite. Government can also do the opposite. It can stifle competition. Y'all know what happened yesterday, February 10th? Do you know that yesterday a certain law went into effect? It's the toy law. As of yesterday, no business can sell a toy, whether new or used, unless it is it has been inspected and verified to be safe in terms of certain lead and certain plastics. You go down to the Goodwill here near the mall, and there's no toy in the stores. Now, what companies can afford to to have a toy inspected, even if it's a used toy, it costs thousands of dollars. So who benefit? What toy companies benefit from that law, and what companies are going out of business? I mean, is it just small companies? You know, the Salvation Army and companies like that. I mean, are they the ones benefit? Or is it your big toy companies that have got deep pockets? And if you drive many small toy companies out of business, who gains? The big toy companies. Now, what we've got here is a government law that favors big business over small business. You see? So what I'm saying here, see, we're talking about government and the role of government in our economy. And I'm saying that a positive aspect of government is to promote more competition, to level the playing field, to make things more fair. But what I'm also saying is that there's a right way of doing things and a wrong way of doing things if you appreciate a free market type system. And the government can also play a role by partnering with big business and then passing laws to the detriment of the small business. And there's many, many examples of that. Because there's a over the past several years, there's been a tight a relationship between government and big business. I mean, there's all kinds of examples of that. I mean, Hank Paulson, who was our Secretary of the Treasury under the Bush administration, who was he before he became Secretary of Treasury? Yeah, he was the top CEO of Bear Stearns, an investment bank. When he left Bear Stearns, they gave him a $50 million severance pay. I mean, just to leave. That was apart from, stock options and hundreds of millions and other monies. So we take him, who's part of the big banks, and then put him as Secretary of Treasury. And I mean, the point I'm making is that, see, there's a relationship here between government and big business, particularly banks, which is not a healthy thing. So, boy, that's a heavy, isn't it? Well, we've got run out of time here. This class is over at 1:45, right? So, I'll continue this next time here on slide 17. So, I shall see you all next time.